Linda Gartz, how are you? We're going to do the formal interview starting at exactly 10:06 after the news. But your book, Redlined, A Memoir of Race, Change, and Fractured Community in 1960s Chicago, is getting a great deal of attention. It must be very gratifying for you, because this is the story not only of the city of Chicago, but of your grandparents and your parents, and most intimately, I think, you and your husband sitting over there taking pictures. How hard was it to do this?
Ooh,
in a big picture. We'll get into more detail after the news.
I understand. Yeah, no, I would say it was very hard. What somebody at a recent presentation asked me, what was the thing that surprised you most about this writing? And I said how hard it was. So that is, it took a very long time first for me to realize that I had been a TV writer, but that didn't make me a writer.
Yeah.
And secondly, to try to figure out what was the story I wanted to tell.
Why did you want to tell this story?
Well,
don't talk about what you found that compelled you to do it. But why, so many people, I guess we all get to a certain age and say, well, I want to sort of understand where I came from. But many people don't. Many people want to keep, if not the secrets, the intimate details of their past quiet. What compelled you to speak in print? Was it important for you? I don't think it was this kind of psycho self-therapy at all. I think it was a way to understand not just who your grandparents and parents were, but to understand, in a way, yourself.
First of all, I think the first part of your question is something I realized early on, is that I did want to understand what happened with my parents, and especially their relationship. But as it went on, and really it took me just really until recently to realize that what I was really doing was trying to understand myself, trying to understand why I reacted the way I did to my parents' relationship getting rather fractured.
Well, there are reasons why it fractured, complicated reasons, many of them, I think, having to do with this this wild city in which we all live. I think that puts a certain stress on that relationship. So you have had a taste of Linda Gartz. You will get the full meal after the news, so please stay tuned. Again, the book is Redlined, A Memoir of Race, Change, and Fractured Community in 1960s Chicago. One of the communities that fractured was her own family. So please stay tuned. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago. If you have a smart speaker, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. That actually, I'm cutting off one of my favorite songs, Frank Sinatra singing from the Gershwin Brothers, because one of the most, I think, important books recently published in this town, and there are a lot of books published in and about this town, is the one I'm holding in my hands. It is titled Redline, A Memoir of Race, Change, and Fractured Community in 60s Chicago. It is by a former TV producer, former teacher, Linda Gartz. Linda, welcome to the show, and I do mean that, because this book, though I did not grow up in a neighborhood that was as fractured and uneasy as yours, I grew up in the 60s in Chicago, and I think, in some ways, this book, I knew many of the things here, but it hit home very, very serious way. If you'd allow me, I want to just read, hoping people, and those of you of a certain generation will so get this. I want to read a paragraph if I could.
Sure.
Could I?
I'd love that.
On the night of August 14th, 1965, my 19-year-old brother Paul walked toward flames on Chicago's deserted Madison Street. He couldn't reconcile the West Side he'd known since birth with the mayhem unfolding just ahead, where crashing glass and the sucking swoosh of Molotov cocktails played against a smoky red sky. As Paul headed east toward Pulaski Road, a scrum of black men turned a corner and came into view. In moments, they surrounded Paul. One said to him, "What you doing here, white boy? Don't you know they're killing your kind?" That is as strong a start to a book as I can remember reading in some time. You're a talented writer. How did a TV producer become a talented writer? I love TV producers, Sharon Barrett, if you're listening. But this is a vastly different kind of writing.
It is. And what the way that came about, I'm so glad you actually made it much even more exciting than I think it was written, the way you
read
it.
It's chilling. I mean, on one level, that's a chilling paragraph. And I think many of us of a certain age have experienced something similar, maybe not in 65, but certainly in around 68.
Yes, well, that's exactly the way my brother told it to me. I obviously was not with him, but
sure.
he told me the story, and I wrote it down. You know, I took it word for word as he said it. But I didn't know I was going to start with that in the beginning. Anyway, you asked me about TV producing and then writing.
Right.
Well, I had, as you mentioned, been a TV documentary producer, and when I came across this vast collection of letters and diaries that my parents had left behind, and I started reading it, and I thought, well, I have to write something about this. I didn't know what. And I started trying to work on it and write it, and I kept trying to write, and it kept coming out really bad.
Interesting.
And I realized that, and this was in 2002, and I realized that this is a very different type of writing. I mean, when you write a TV documentary, I'm basically writing transitions.
Sure.
So I thought I could write, but I realized I didn't know how to write. So I started taking classes at Northwestern at night in the School of Professional Studies. And then I joined writing groups, and then I took more classes, and then I continued to submit my work to this writing group, who was a wonderful writing group up in Glencoe, a group of mostly women, men as well. And they're very, very talented, and they were able to tell me each week, you know, what was wrong with my writing as well as what was good about it. You know, they'd start with what's
good. Boy, that's very brave of you, because you've had an accomplished career, and to realize that you needed some, if not professional, at least semi-professional help in marshaling this. When you say, Linda Gartz, a vast repository of journals and diaries and notes and letters, you do mean vast. Could you give the listeners a description of how vast this was? I mean, it seemed to me at one point, when you describe it here, it's so vast as to be almost undigestible.
Well, let's put it this way. When my mom died, my brothers and I had to go through the house to get it ready for sale, and we were separating trash from treasure. And when we got to the attic, we found our gold, as we said. And we just found that my grandparents, who had already died, had saved, you know, over 300 World War II letters. We had letters from Romania, which I couldn't read, and that became a whole separate project that didn't get into the book at all. My parents, we discovered, both had kept letters and diaries. They had written to each other for 13 years when my dad traveled. My mom started a diary when she was 10. My dad, obviously, they didn't know each other when they were children or young people, but he kept a diary when he was 19 to the ages of 21. Then in 1950, my dad started traveling, and I think he just felt compelled to start writing things down.
What was this? How do you? My parents and grandparents of similar vintage did not do this. And was it a Germanic? How do you explain? Because it is what gives your book, Redlined, incredible heft and incredible narrative drive. How do you figure? Why would they? Who would they? You know, it's a mystery. It's one of those great mysteries.
You know, I think they very much liked words, for one thing. My dad liked to write poetry. I think I have the portion of one poem he wrote to my mother on their 10th anniversary in there. But he wrote poetry to a lot of people. He wrote me a beautiful poem on my 10th birthday.
You and your dad were very close, were you not?
Yes, yeah. I felt very close to my dad.
Before we take a break, I'm going to read something, another thing. It's always a good sign when I'm reading things.
I'm glad
book.
You are. Thank you.
This is from the first date of Lillian and Fred, who were the parents of my guest, Linda Gartz. They went to, they strolled around, they went to a German movie, they went to Lincoln Park Zoo, they got some beer at the Siebens Brewery, they went back to the park. When she got home, Lillian wrote this: "I think we both knew why we went back to the park. We sat on a bench hearing the lion's roar and the quacking of a duck. Oh, it was heavenly. He knows all the little innuendos of kissing, and I ain't so bad myself, if I do say so. We kissed for about an hour and a half. Tonight was like a page from a storybook, and he definitely is the man I want to marry. Dear God, please let it come true." That is an amazing, amazing paragraph to me. We've got to take a commercial break, and I got to tell you this, and then we're going to carry on with Linda Gartz. We've just started. Her parents just met, for goodness sake. We have a lot to talk about. Get to know Joe starting Monday. Joe Donlan joins Micah Mater on WGN TV News at 5, 6, 9, and 10. That's starting Monday. I'll also tell you that tomorrow morning, Ryan Nobles from CNN joins Steve Cochran's show for an update on the political climate in D.C. Well, there's a show that could take 18 hours. Monday morning at 7:40 on WGN TV and WGN Radio, 7:20 WGN.
There are certain musical comedy and motion picture scores that will always live in the memories of those who saw the operetta or the picture. One of these memorable scores is, I think, the one George Gershwin
That's
did.
That's Frank Sinatra talking. How unusual. I am talking to Linda Gartz, the author of Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and fractured community. In 1960, Chicago, I asked her to describe my last question to her, because I wanted to read something that her mom wrote after first date with her dad. You said the collection of journals and letters and everything was vast. When you decided to dive into that, you and your brothers, with the intention, what was your intention? Just a, sort of a sense of, let's see what's in here?
Well, first of all, as you could tell with my parents and grandparents keeping all this stuff, I think this is nature and nurture. We have a rather compulsive and work-oriented family.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we found, and we've always been very family-oriented in terms of family history. My mother would tell us about her great-great-grandfather, and Dad would tell us about how his dad got here on the top of a train. And so we just knew we couldn't throw this out. So we had to, and we're pretty organized, so we decided that we had to find a way to organize this. And right then and there, as we undid, not undid, but when, as we found
opened
things.
Opened something, yeah.
Opened things, we'd say, okay, this is the Lillian Gartz box. This is the, you know, grandparent Gartz box. This is the box for my mother's parents. This is the box for Uncle Frank. This is the box, and so on. So we originally separated everything and labeled each box. And then I said to my brothers, you know, we really need to find out more detail about what's in there. They came back several years later, and we started making this spreadsheet.
Yeah, what you showed me here is fascinating. Yeah. A lot of work involved in that, too, Linda.
Well, it's, you know, as I said, compulsive family. So my older brother, who is an aerospace engineer, sat at the computer while my younger brother and I took each thing out of the box, and he typed it into the spreadsheet.
Mm.
And then we put it back, and now I have a spreadsheet to easily find things. But I let it sit in my garage. I have a bigger garage than they had in there in Seattle. So it sat in my garage, all these 25 banker's boxes, for many years. And finally, it was this, like, siren song that drew me to it. I've got to see what's in there. I felt I couldn't let it lie.
Yeah.
And I started with the World War II letters because I had never met my uncle. And I was completely sucked in.
Sure.
So that was what started it, is I just read these letters and I felt, I now know this young man that I had never known.
Was there any sense of trepidation? Was there any sense of a mild anxiety about finding something you didn't want to or need to know? Was there any of that?
Not really. I actually wanted to know.
Okay.
No,
good, bad, dark and light. And you were willing to accept that.
I didn't
that.
Care. Right. A friend of mine has a phrase that says, people who look under fences get dirty faces. And I don't buy that. I think that you can often be enlightened, and that's what I was looking for.
Well, you obviously were enlightened. I mean, both sides of the family are fascinating, but your mother's parents seem to be the more, not if not damaged, and I'm not going to say more interesting, less conventional. How does that strike you?
You're speaking of my mom's mother?
Yeah.
Well, she was mentally ill.
Yeah.
And her, you know, and even when she was a young mother, I could see, and my mother started a diary at age 10, and so I really learned about my mother's childhood, and I could see that her mother early on had what we would call anger management problems.
Yeah.
She wasn't mentally ill, I don't think, when my mom was young, but she...
Certain instability in that household.
Yeah. She was very, she would just fly off the handle for no reason. And, you know, my mom was an only child, so she had to...
Take the brunt of it.
Yeah. But at the same time, this is the thing that I found so interesting. She would often say, my mother was so good to me. I loved my mother. And then she would say, I was afraid of my mother.
Ugh.
So I found this dichotomy really something worth exploring. So that's what I wanted to
do. You do a great job of exploring it. The book, you eventually, the gist of it is... And it is a story of a relationship, basically, between your parents, but also the relationship between your family to the city in which you chose to live. You, not specifically, you were on West Washington Street. Your parents were kind of, I don't know whether, sort of real estate entrepreneurial, were they? That's a pretty accurate phrase, right?
Well, you know, my grandfather arrived in America in 1911 and came to Chicago sometime in spring. I have his letters between him and my grandmother. They wrote each other, and they kept diaries, too. They were compulsive.
I'm going to ask you a question. Do you keep a diary?
I don't.
Okay. I just needed to know.
I keep thinking I should, but I just... I don't have time, frankly.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
Although I can't compare the...
Well, this is kind of like your diary, Red
Line.
Yeah,
I guess so. This is why I wanted to... This is an exploration of family and trying to understand relationships and, as I said, our fractured community.
Sure.
So I don't keep a diary.
So they wind up... You were saying they... The building was at 4222 West Washington.
Yes.
And this was where you grew up.
Correct.
This was... at the center of the East Garfield, West Garfield area that was all white when you moved in there,
yep.
Remained almost all white. And the backdrop of the story of this fascinating, and I must say, fascinating family, and a good family, I think.
They were nice. Very
you, your brothers, and... your parents and your grandmother's a little crazy, but my mom was a little crazy. What happened in that neighborhood? Because it is a story that people around this city, maybe people in Roseland, will also share. The African Americans in this town began to move out of the proverbial Black Belt, where they had been horribly ghettoized and rent gouged and everything else. When did you first see a black person move into your neighborhood? Was it 63?
Yes. The first African American moved onto our block in 1963, June 22nd. And I have to say, this was at the height of the civil rights movement.
Sure.
We had just seen the Birmingham protests with hoses, you know, trained on young children and dogs. We had seen the governor of Alabama stand at the state university and say to citizens who had paid taxes, you may not come here, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. So everything that in our lives was about race at this time.
Yep.
Everything on the news was about race. President Kennedy had to go on national TV to tell America to please treat its black citizens fairly. And the next day, Medgar Evers was murdered in his driveway.
Right, right.
And 10 days after Medgar Evers was murdered, the first African American moved onto our block. So race was national on the news. Race was in our own neighborhood.
And then race came knocking in your neighborhood and various neighborhoods around this city.
Yes. Well, one of the things, what happened, of course, which is what happened in most neighborhoods where the first African American moved, is the whites started moving out.
Yeah.
And we stayed. For whatever reason, we just decided we didn't. There was no decision. It was just like, we're staying.
I know other people did, too. And I think one of the reasons you address in the book, Redlining, is that there was some really unscrupulous real estate people who would come and knock on a door and say, hey, look who moved down the street. You better get out of here before they bring, you know, idiotically, before they move in all of their friends. So they would get people to sell for lower prices, and they would gouge the African Americans coming in. But your family decided to stay. Your family had, it seems to me, no predisposition to like or not like African Americans.
Well, that's not really exactly correct. I think that
he didn't want to rent. Your dad did not feel like renting.
Yeah.
To an African American.
I think, you know, as I mentioned in the book, you know, we didn't know African Americans. There was sort of no way for whites to get to know African Americans.
No question.
They were not on TV. They were not in, you know, in white magazines.
They were not in your neighborhood.
They were not in the neighborhood.
Not in your workplace most of the time.
Correct. So their stereotypes ruled. And the rule was that when you went into a black neighborhood, you saw a very slum-like appearance. And that was one of the things I wanted to explore in the book, is why was this so? Now, what I realized is that this was because of government policy called redlining. It was the segregation was actually done by our government.
Yeah.
And, you know, if people couldn't get a home loan, like if your sagging front porch needed to be fixed and you couldn't get a home loan to fix that, then your porch looked saggy and your neighborhood looked slummy.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, what whites made the assumption was that, well, it's the blacks' fault, as
opposed to, because
we had no idea that they were making these redlining maps that specifically segregated.
Yeah, it's insidious.
I really want to say, because this is really important for people to understand, if one black person moved into a community, these maps, which were started during the Roosevelt administration and were used to determine which neighborhoods were safe for loans, if one African-American person was in a neighborhood, nobody in that neighborhood could get a loan.
I know.
So
that is a tragic thread in this, in Linda Gartz's book, Redlined. It has made this city the way this city is.
It's nationwide.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go to any city in the country, and you can go on a site called Mapping Inequality, and you can put in the name of virtually any city in the country and look at the original redlining maps from 1940.
It gives me the chills.
Yeah, I know.
That is why this is not only I will tell you that the book is entertaining on a number of different levels, but it's also chilling on a couple of levels, too.
Yeah.
And that is certainly one of them. I'm going to keep Linda until after the news, so please stay tuned. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago. If you have a smart speaker, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. 10:30 here with the news, Roger Badish.
A man robbed and sexually abused a woman on a Brown Line platform in the Ravenswood Manor neighborhood late Thursday, according to a community alert issued on Sunday. Happened at the Francisco Brown Line station. Man described as African American, 18 to 25 years of age, about 5'7 to 5'11, weighing 150 and 180 pounds. Hair was in dreadlocks with red or auburn highlights. Last seen wearing a red sweatsuit with a white and black insignia on the front of both the pants and shirt. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned the attack on a voter registration center in Afghanistan. A suicide bombing in Kabul killed at least 57 people and was claimed by the Islamic State group. It's almost free Wi-Fi at O'Hare and Midway. There used to be a 30-minute limit on free usage, but now it's unlimited, except every 45 minutes you'll see ads before you can use that service again. We'll check sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
Townstone Financial is synonymous with great rates, low closing costs, and phenomenal service to the thousands who have completed purchases and refinances with us since 2002. Hi, my name is Barry Sterner, owner of Townstone Financial. Let's hear from Jim, who just completed a no-cost refinance with Townstone Financial.
I would recommend Townstone to anybody, and I do. I always knew where we were. I knew the dates. I knew when I had to have information. There was no fire drills. The overall experience was, off the charts. I've not experienced, there's very few companies that I've encountered that really deliver that customer experience, and that's what sets you guys apart, hands down.
Remember, nobody values your business more than Townstone Financial, and I'm always available to answer your questions. Call me now, Barry Sterner, 312-896-2111. That's 312-896-2111, or go to townstone.com. That's TOWNSTONE.com.
Townstone Financials, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, Illinois, mortgage licensee 6629 and NMLS 136639, equal housing lender.
Sometimes our hearts don't perform as they should. They race, flutter, skip beats. At North Shore Cardiovascular Institute, our team of leading electrophysiologists is pioneering the latest care for abnormal heart rhythms. From implanting the world's smallest pacemaker to performing radiation-free ablation for AFib. All to get your heart back to normal. North Shore University Health System. Healthcare for what's next. Northshore.org/cardio.
Papa Nicola's Coffee is Chicago's number one premium coffee and is served at WGN. Find Papa Nicola's Coffee at grocery stores throughout Chicagoland or at papanicolas.com. Pick up a bag of Papa today.
Checking WGN Sports, not good news on the south side. WGN's Kevin Powell has details.
A rough go of it for the Sox this weekend with the reigning World Series champs in town. They were swept at home, losing 7-1 in the finale against the Houston Astros. And despite all the losses, manager Rick Renteria says the team is remaining positive as this rebuild rolls on.
The only guy that can bring these guys down is going to be me. And that's not going to happen. I'll pick these guys up every single day, not that they need it.
A bright spot for the Sox was righty pitcher Reynaldo Lopez. He pitched five innings, kept the Astros' bats at bay, giving up just one run, but a crooked number posted in the seventh. The Sox bullpen surrendering five runs. Aaron Bummer takes the loss. Sox open up a home series with the Mariners Monday night. Covering the White Sox, Kevin Powell, WGN Sports.
And the Cubs losing to Colorado, Cubs beating Colorado 9-7. Let's check WGN traffic. Esmeralda Leon.
Right now we're seeing some minor delays on the Kennedy on both sides. You're looking at 18 minutes to and from O'Hare. On the inbound side, you have roadwork, Ohio Feeder to the Eisenhower, a left lane down. On the Edens at 16 in both directions, the Eisenhower is looking good. Stevenson clear and the Dan Ryan. We are seeing delays on the inbound side. Taylor to the Eisenhower, you have a left lane closed. It's about 16 minutes right now from 95th to the circle. Outbound is 14. Lakeshore Drive is clear. Bishop Ford, I-57, all running at the with no delays. On the tolls right now, you're seeing some scattered delays on 294 right around Cermak as well as I-80. For personalized traffic on demand, get the Traffic's Chicago app approved by Team Hochberg at Pearl Mortgage. Just search TRAFFIX Chicago. Esmeralda Leon, WGN Traffic Central.
And your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Rest of the overnight, partly cloudy, breezy, low around 39. Monday, mostly sunny, windy, high near 61. Right now, 46 at O'Hare, 48 at Midway, 43 at Portage, 44 along the lakefront, Lake Michigan water temperature at 43. Winds out of the northeast at 9. Get Chicago news first at the top of every hour. I'm Roger Battish on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
It ain't necessarily so.
Frank Sinatra, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Rick Kogan. Linda Gertz is sitting with me here at the beginning of Chapter 19. Another thing about you, former television producer, you may still do that for all I know, but now I think accomplished book writer, another of your literary gifts is the short chapters. This is a book of short chapters. Was that conscious, or was that something you learned in with your new writing colleagues? Because I think it works beautifully.
Well, you know,
felt that way to you?
I read, one of the things I did besides just taking some classes is I read a ton of memoirs, and I read a ton of books about how to write a memoir.
Oh, interesting.
So I did a lot of, you know, I would analyze memoirs,
yeah,
like Cheryl Strayed's book on Wild about walking the Pacific Crest Trail. I mean, many. And one thing I noticed in many of these books is the chapters were short, and they keeps you moving, I think.
It worked. Here is the beginning of chapter 19. Oblivious to the family drama, I lived happily in a child's world. West Garfield Park in the 1950s was like a small town, where we knew our neighbors and shopkeepers and could walk to nearby Madison Street, our business district, to purchase whatever we needed. For a kid, it was a place of freedom and adventure. I think that is true probably of virtually every neighborhood in the city at that time. Could you give me some detail, please? You do in the book, but you give the listeners some details. You found a cool boyfriend who you're still with. Yeah, right.
Well, you know, like you said, we used to play in the alley. I mean, the alley was our playground. People are shocked by that today, but
sure.
We'd walk to school. I would walk down the alley to my school. The kids would bounce balls. We climbed up gutters to get onto roofs, to peer into sometimes unguarded windows.
Of course, sure.
You know, why not, right?
Sure.
And we bounced balls, and we walked everywhere. When I was 6 years old, my mother sent me on an errand across Washington Boulevard to go to a bakery.
Wow.
To pick up a loaf of bread, and I still remember pulling the little number off.
Yeah, of course.
And when they called my number, I was just this little six-year-old, and I go, here? And I remember everybody turned to look at me and went, aw. And I thought, why are they going, aw?
It's like a rite of passage. It's bigger than a communion doing that thing.
So when I was eight, my brother and I took the Chicago public transportation ourselves to Columbus Park Day Camp. You know, my mom was...
I think it did for me. It gives you a sense of self-sufficiency at a very early age and of being able to do things on your own that now in the era of helicopter parents... And I know it's dangerous. It may be dangerous out there. I don't think it's any more dangerous than it ever has been. That's one man's theory.
You know, it's interesting. You may have heard, I'm sure you've heard of this concept of free range parenting.
Oh, sure, yeah.
It's just come up like in Utah, like they have to pass a law to tell parents it's okay to let their kids.
That gets a little nuts. I mean, the free range parenting is kind of like, yeah, sure, go to Lincoln Park Zoo. Sure, you can jump in with the, if you can get in with the tigers, say hello for me. Yeah,
no, I think what this part of it what came out of is somebody called the police or DCFS on a parent who let their child walk to school.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think you're right. We, at a very early age, thought nothing of taking care of ourselves. Now, again, I'm not saying that you send a four-year-old to go and cross the street.
Right.
You have to be wise about it. But we did have a sense of confidence, I think, very early
on. I agree. And I think that's an important thing. When did that shatter for you? Was it 65? There were riots in Chicago that were certainly overshadowed by the riots in Watts, California. There were serious riots here. I read the beginning of Linda Gartz's remarkable book, where her brother gets in a slight jam. I'm going to ask you, what's Garfield Park, when did you get scared?
You know, I didn't really get scared, I would say. I mean, we were cautious. It's like that one part where my mother says when she goes out at night by herself, she says no one else goes out at night by themselves. The stores are closing half an hour earlier. She says, I go out and I'm not foolhardy. I'm cautious. I keep a little can of spray in my pocket, but I'm not scared. And I don't think we ever really felt scared. But we were cautious. It's sort of like if you walk around the city today.
Yeah, sure.
You don't feel scared, but you better keep your eyes open and not, you know, let your purse hang down and look like you're, you know, out of it. So We just were cautious, but we just didn't seem like my dad would pick me up if I came home after dark. He mm-hmm. would meet me at the bus stop. He knew that it was better to do that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, I didn't have any panicky feeling. Even after the riots, I remember I came home because I had been on an overnight. I actually had not been there.
Right.
And when I came home.
What was your friend's name? What was it?
A Peggy?
You had some nice friends in this book. There's some nice friends in this
Peggy was wonderful and is wonderful. She's still my friend today.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Very dear friend.
I'll bet. Tell me about, I think there's no question that Bill, who is sitting in the studio with us, is an important element in your life. How did you first meet Bill? I mean, I could read something here, but how?
Tell me. Okay. Well, again, Peggy came into play, my good friend Peggy. There was a party that was going on in Park Ridge. I went to Luther North High School because my parents were afraid to send me into East Garfield Park to Austin at the time.
Sure.
Not to Austin, to Marshall. So I didn't want to go to this party, but Peggy said, come on, you got to go, Gertz. She called me Gertz. So we got to the party and walked down the stairs, and this person I'd never seen asked Peggy to dance, and the next thing I knew, this young man with a Beatles haircut and kind of
soft... It was
soft,
a cute Beatles haircut.
Soft,
there's a picture in
soft
here.
Soft hazel eyes.
Yeah.
Came up to me to ask me to dance, and then we spent the whole rest of the evening. We talked the whole evening. It was kind of like my mom would say about my dad, we never ran out of things to talk about. Yeah. Same thing. We never ran out of things to talk about. So,
and he's sitting here and he's smiling. and plus, he's a lawyer. we're going to take another little break. I was going to play a couple other studs things, but I want to keep Linda for the whole hour, if that's okay. Oh. Can you stay for another 10 minutes or so?
I can stay as long as you
like. Because I think you should buy this book, Redlined, A Memoir of Race Change and Fractured Community in 60s Chicago. It will resonate with thousands of you who were a part of that city at that time. And I want to talk to Linda about the fact that what happened during to her parents and to her neighborhood has cast a shadow that remains on that neighborhood. And when you're disenfranchised in this time, you stay disenfranchised. And I want to see if there's any sense of hope. And also, if it's not too painful, talk about your folks. Okay?
Well, I will start with the neighborhood.
We don't have to do it now. I'm going to take a commercial break.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I don't care. Don't be sorry. You can do it anytime, but that's what we'll talk about when we get back from this commercial break.
It's wonderful. It's marvelous. You should care for me.
That, again, was the last time you'll hear Frank Sinatra during After Hours. Linda Gartz's book, Redlined, A Memoir of Race Change and Fractured Community in 1960s Chicago, is a remarkable book on a number of different levels. It's a family tale. It is a very personal tale of growing up. You're mm-hmm. growing up, and finding yourself and what you do, and having friends and having a good life. And it is also a story of a neighborhood that was beaten up and has yet. I mean, obviously, Linda Gartz, you have gone back to West Garfield Park and you have seen what West Garfield Park looks like, and perhaps you've talked to some people. You talked to people who have, and they're in the book too, who have lived there. It must, on some level, for you, be kind of heartbreaking to know that there are little girls out there now who are not going to be able to have the kind of experiences that you had growing up. That it just doesn't exist for them. It must break your heart a bit.
Well, it does, because, you know, that neighborhood was so vibrant. When I lived on Washington Boulevard, we were a block from Madison. Madison and Pulaski was the big commercial district, one of the biggest in the city.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had department stores, we had bakeries, we had paint stores, we had delicatessens and restaurants and movie theaters. And it was like a small town. And yeah, everything you needed, you could walk to. And, of course, after the riots that we were, that we've just revisited in the last few weeks because of the 50th anniversary of King's murder, that area was devastated. The businesses all left. It was left with no economic base. And so people can't shop in their own neighborhood.
Yeah.
And little girls like I was today, you know, cannot just walk to Madison Street and go to the bakery and buy something. And they also have to be worried about being shot. I mean, West Garfield Park is one of the...
It's the most dangerous...
One of the most dangerous neighborhoods.
2014, or you cite that in the book, too, was the most dangerous neighborhood.
Yeah.
If not in Chicago, in the world or something.
Well, if you keep it... Yeah,
yeah.
To continue to extrapolate. So I kept thinking this neighborhood has to, you know, come back in some way. But the city has really... completely ignore these people on this neighborhood, the whole neighborhood. And I do find that heartbreaking. I want to just give a plug for Bethel New Life, because
sure,
Bethel was my church and my father's church. He was confirmed there in the 20s, married there. That was my church. When I met my now husband, I was still teaching Sunday school at Bethel. And a new pastor came in 1965 with his sister to help him, Mary Nelson. She started out as a tenant in my parents' basement apartments. And she went on to found Bethel New Life, which became one of the most successful community development organizations in the country. And so they really put a lot of effort, and she raised grants. And it's with everything that they have done, and it's been massive, from childcare to assisted living, the neighborhood is still suffering. And
do you see, can you exercise any hope?
Well, there's,
you seem like a hopeful person. I mean, you can't.
Yes, there's always hope. You know, the big fear now for the residents who live there is that, in a way, hope is built in with the neighborhood getting better, which means gentrification, which then is become a bugaboo word for many people.
Well, I mean, the whole new police academy, kind of $95 million. To my mind, I'm sure we need a new police academy, but it seems to me that $95 million could be spread around a little more with maybe some small manufacturing outfit. I'm not an urban planner, but I think you're right that the fear now in some neighborhoods like West Garfield Park is that gentrification comes,
then
people have to leave.
Yeah. So, and I agree with you about that $95 million for the police academy. I read in one article recently, and I don't want to get this wrong, but something like $1 million per block is sometimes spent on incarceration efforts.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
You know, just keeping track of parolees and getting people in jail. And why don't you take that money and invest it in the neighborhood instead of focusing on this incarceration, this mass incarceration of African-American men? So there are problems on many levels. But the hope, we'll see what the police academy does, but I'm really not. If the city doesn't care, like I say, Bethel New Life, they put millions of dollars into this community, and it's still not where we'd like to see it. So I think the city has to care about this neighborhood.
It was a good neighborhood for you. There's no question about it. But I think the strain and struggles that your parents, Lillian and Fred, had to go through fractured that relationship from that incredibly tender first date note. To what? What happened? And you learned, I mean, obviously you saw some of it firsthand, but you also learned some of the details from the voluminous, as you called it, vast repository of personal letters and journals. Do you mind talking about this?
No, I think, because that was really one of the goals, I would say, I had in going through all this vast collection of journals and diaries and letters, is I was trying to figure out what happened to my parents' relationship, especially after I found that early diary of them falling in love and how madly in love they were.
God, no kidding.
So sweet. And then I thought, what happened? Because when I was a teen and young adult, they were definitely not happy. So
yeah, how did that unhappiness manifest itself? How did you sense it?
I didn't have to sense it. well, my mom became extremely angry with my father, and I didn't understand why, because I thought my dad was a great guy.
Sure.
But she was screaming at him and talking about how he didn't treat her right and that she was nothing but a workhorse and what did he expect of her. And I didn't know where this came
from. You didn't see this coming at all.
I didn't. And in reading the letters and diaries, I realized that this difficulty had begun actually when I was a very little child, but they had hid it from us masterfully. So I never sensed any problems. As if anything, as I kind of show in the book, they seemed to have a wonderful relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they were happy, but there were currents of unhappiness that were already being seeded because of my dad's insistence on this rooming house while he traveled 6 months of the year.
Right. That even I, who am no expert in relationships, can see that would be trouble brewing.
Yeah. I've come to the conclusion that he was trying to please his parents in doing that because he was trying to show them how hard he could work.
Right.
At the same time, my mother was trying to mollify her mother, who was mentally ill.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
living with us yeah. and really a danger and a very fracturing influence on their relationship.
Oh, no question.
So each of them, I think, in their own way, was trying to please the individual respective parents.
Yeah.
And in doing so, were damaging their own relationship. But I'm not sure. I don't think it was conscious. I don't think they were saying, I'm going to please my mother rather
right.
than my wife.
No, of course. I think you're right. It was reactive. You end. It's a kind ending to this book, I think. Do you?
Well, yes. I mean, we don't want to do a spoiler, do we?
No.
No. I was trying to find, I felt that this was the ending that comes up.
Yep.
Where they do come back together under very unusual circumstances.
Yes.
That kind of showed that love was still there.
At
underneath it all, underneath all the anger and the retreat and disappointment, when the chips were down, loyalty was there.
Yeah, I think you're so right. Now that you have written a book that is getting praise all over the place, including for me, if you've been listening for the last hour, has it emboldened you? Has it empowered you? Has it given you the notion of, we'll see what Bill has to say about this just through his eyes, it giving you the notion for another book? Look at him. He's like, no! What are you, nuts, Rick?
Well, I do think I have to take a break. If anything, I think rather than a book, I could see a series of essays because there was so much
that's
I had to cut.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah. I had to cut so much from this book. There were so many interesting stories, and you can't have a book be all over the place in terms of its focus. So I would see writing essays about what had happened. I have a bunch of essays I've already written. I've got chapters that
you've obviously done a lot of research about Chicago, too. You know, essays about the city and what the city can do.
Exactly.
Do you miss TV?
I liked TV very much. I really enjoyed working in it. The last documentary I did, which is now almost 10 years ago, I had it became to the point where it wasn't worth it for me anymore. I had to work 12 hours a day to get it done.
Well, that business has changed remarkably in the last decade or so. Linda Garst, congratulations. I am so glad you got in touch, and I am so glad I read this book, and I'm so glad I know you and Bill.
Well,
and in a way, I know your parents and grandparents, too.
You do.
For better and worse. For better and worse. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate your having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. My plan. Good luck with the book. You're going to be on the morning shift on WBZ in a week or so, next week?
Yeah, May 4th.
Good.
And also a podcast called The Zebra Sisters.
The Zebra Sisters at the Sun-Times. Leslie Baldacci and Mary Mitchell. That'll be fun.
Yeah,
that'll be fun.
Looking forward to that.
Thank you. Bill, great to meet you, too.